Okay, how to study the Bible. Today, looking at a good translation. And again, we're starting a new section of this, going through the book, How to Study the Bible for All It's Worth by Gordon Fee. And kind of following along with that, although not necessarily exactly, especially at the conclusions at the end, I disagree with his conclusions, so could make some different conclusions, but let's go ahead and dive in. And I was hoping to get this all today. I don't know that we're going to. We may have to go a couple of weeks into this, but let's see where we get. So let's go ahead and begin. The point is, if we're going to study the Bible, we need to have a translation to study in it, because I don't think anybody here, I don't do Greek or Hebrew very well, and I think I'm the only one that's actually studied it with much depth. You probably studied a little bit in your studies, at least Greek. So in general, if we're going to study the Bible, as most people in the world, we need to have the Bible in our language. Now, for most countries, most nations, most people throughout time, there hasn't been a lot of options. You had the translation you had, and that was that. There's still a lot of cultures today that they're fortunate to have a single translation in their language. But in the U.S., we have a variety of translations, in English anyway, and not just the U.S., but any English-speaking country. And as a result, we have some options and flexibility when it comes to translations that most nations do not have. And so that's but there's some benefits with that brings to us, but it also brings its own set of pitfalls, and both good translations, bad translations, and things like that. So we want to think today about some ways to think through choosing a translation for our personal study. So the first thing to think about is the scripture was actually written in three languages. Does anybody know what those three languages are? Two of them are obvious. The third one, a lot of people don't realize there's a third language that was used. Aramaic is the third, so along with Hebrew and Greek. It's mostly in Hebrew and Greek. The entire New Testament is in Greek, except for a couple of words here and there. The Old Testament is almost entirely in Hebrew, but there are some passages, especially in the latter prophets. So Daniel, about half of Daniel's in Aramaic, and some other chapters here and there are in Aramaic. And as we get to, by the end of the New Testament era, before the Greek era, Aramaic had become the universal trade language in the Middle East, and so most of the nations spoke that. Remember when they're trying to attack Hezekiah, and they've got Hezekiah surrounded, and they're gonna basically give him the ultimatums, and his generals say, "Speak in Aramaic, because we speak Aramaic." The point was, they spoke in Aramaic, the people of Jerusalem didn't speak Aramaic, so they wanted to speak in Aramaic, so the people of Jerusalem wouldn't know just how dire the situation was. And of course, the enemy said, "No, we're going to speak to you in Hebrew because we want your people to know just how dire your situation is." And but Aramaic had become the primary trade language, and so parts of the New Testament are parts of the Old Testament are in Aramaic. Now, just to follow up on that, back a few years ago, and I say a few years ago, back I think in the 70s, 60s and 70s, there was a couple of men who decided the New Testament was written in Aramaic, and that the Greek copies we have are copies of the Aramaic, and we need to reject that idea. And in fact, we had a man come through our church here in the very early days and took me to task for being confessional when the confession says the New Testament is written in Greek, because don't you know the Greek New Testament, if you really knew what you're talking about, you would know the New Testament was written in Aramaic. And that theory has been completely debunked. There's hardly anybody at the academic level that still holds to that. It's nonsense. Well, yes, most likely Christ and the apostles spoke Aramaic as their daily life. The idea that, and that's why you do see some places in the Greek, that is to say, and they'll give for something like that means such and such, they're giving the Aramaic initially and then translating what wasn't Greek, but the actual writing was done in Greek because that was the common language of the day. Now, having said that, so as we come to these things, translation, as we translate from Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic into English, it involves both translation and interpretation. How many here, forget Greek or Hebrew, how many of you speak more than one language? We've got a few people that speak more than one language. How often when you're going from one language to the other, is it a direct one-for-one? It's very, very rare, isn't it? We have to, and we'll think more about some of the details involved that we go through as a big part of today's lesson. But the reality is languages aren't one for one. I think too often when we only speak one language, we have a tendency to think of Think of other languages as like a code. Well, I need to find the opposite, the equal word for it. And think about it for a moment. Even as we try to communicate here, we live in a somewhat bilingual area. And so if I want to go order beans from someplace in Mexico, I ask, what is a bean in Spanish? And like, frijole. And so I think, well, so yes, one for one, beans. And there's kind of a point of fact that we're talking about an actual object, something there. But for most of the language, though, we don't have that direct correlation. When we start, speaking about, how do I say hello? Well, they have a different way of saying hello. It's the words, the intent is the same, but it's not a direct, correlation between the two. And so we need to think about some of those things. So we have to not only translate what the words mean, but we also have to interpret what is the thought trying to be conveyed? What is the point that is being made here? Because things don't always come together like that. So that's what we need to think about as we go through this. So let's think about this morning an example of some of the difficulties that arise. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 36. You don't need to turn there because I've got some examples up here on the board of it. So my point of this is to show the way this verse is translated differently. So the King James translates this, "But if any man think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin." Now, that's a pretty literal translation. But what does it mean? What is his virgin here? And I'm telling you, if you look at the King James, the context, there's nothing to really help you either. It's a pretty literal translation, but it doesn't mean anything. Because it doesn't explain what it is. Now, it's very vague and very things like that. Now, do you think Paul was being vague? No. Paul had something very much in mind. Now, in all of chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians is almost entirely written as Paul's response to their questions. So most likely there was a specific question that was coming from the Corinthian people. Paul's answering the questions. If you have the question, there's no question at all of what he's intending here. We don't have the question, so now we have to try to figure out what he's trying to say. So King James just translates it literally, just straight up, but now we've got to figure out what is meant. So the NASB begins interpretation. "But if any man thinks he is acting unbecomely towards his virgin daughter," so his virgin translated now, virgin daughter, so basically the idea of his daughter. But if we look at the context, that doesn't make any sense. It's an interpretive decision, but it really doesn't make any sense. NIV, as the NIV does, it just straight up interprets it. It doesn't try to translate very much. And so it comes out and says, "If anyone thinks he is acting improperly toward the virgin he is engaged to." Now, the reality is this is actually probably, of the three, the most accurate interpretation. Now, it's not the most accurate translation. It's not the most literal translation, but it's probably the most proper interpretation. It's probably talking about, because if you look at the whole overall context of 1 Corinthians 7, this is the type of thing it's talking about, relations with others, marriage, physical relations with the opposite sex. The ESV follows along kind of in the NIV. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, it just gets rid of the word virgin and looks at it as betrothed, the one he's engaged to. And I believe this is probably a pretty good interpretation. It's not a translation, though. It's not an exact literal translation. The exact literal translation is the King James, but it doesn't make any sense. What does it mean? And so the other translations are trying to interpret. The NASB, it tries to interpret it, but I think does it in a way that doesn't really fit the context. The NIV and the ESV interpret it in a way that much better fits the context. So the point of this, we want to begin off, is when we're talking about translations, there is a sense of interpretation that has to go into it. It's not just what do the specific words one for one mean, but what is the author trying to convey? And so that's an important aspect of this. Now, having said that, let's think for a moment about why then we want a primary translation. So on the one hand, as we can think about things like that, we can go through and we can, for different verses, we can find different places or different translations that are better. So is there a benefit then in just using a whole variety of translations? I know some churches that they don't really have a primary translation. The pastor just gets up and shows on the screen every morning whatever verse whatever translation he thinks fits best to the passage that he's dealing with. And but is there a benefit to a primary translation of having one that we primarily read out of, primarily study out of, things like that? And I believe there is, and we want to think about some of the reasons why that is this morning. There is something to be said about consistency. First of all, as we're going through and we're reading through most of our daily private devotions, things like that, private study, we're not going to be grabbing 15 different translations and flipping through all of them. We need to have something we can be consistent with, we can grab, we can work our way through. And whatever, however good or bad that translation is, it's good to have some consistency. Memorization is important, and the ability to go through and to memorize, to learn, to get a hold of. And again, if we're bouncing around from translation to translation, that's difficult. I struggle to a degree with this even now. I was raised in on the King James Bible, and as a result, most of my memorization is in King James English, which means that now, as in my 40s, as I remember a passage that I want to look up, I have to switch my search engine over to King James so I can search for it in King James English, and then switch back to the ESV to actually use it for things, because my memorization's all in one translation instead of the other. Now, there's nothing wrong with that per se. The point, though, is it's good to have some kind of consistency. For me, growing up, that consistency was King James. Good or bad with the King James translation, it did that consistency I was able to memorize. I memorized it together. And so it's good to pick a translation, especially for our children, that they can begin to learn, they can begin to memorize, and even if they change and they get older, there's that unity of things. And then thirdly, familiarity. This kind of goes together with that. There becomes a familiarity to the language, things like that, as the more time we spend in a specific translation. We kind of know how that translation is structured, how it's worded. There's a lot of benefits for that in our everyday sitting down, reading through Scripture, our basic study, our preaching. You know, one that we'll talk about at the end of the lesson why we want to be careful with this, but why we have chosen a single translation we use here in all the preaching, primarily the ESV. Although again, we'll address some of the problems with the ESV from time to time. But the fact that we can all come together, there's an expectation of familiarity. When people bring their Bibles to church, if you want to bring something else, that's fine. There was a great Babylon Bee article this week. Some of you saw it. It said KJV only church is now requiring everybody to have clear Bible covers so they can make sure nobody's sneaking in the NIV. And you have no such requirements. You can bring whatever translation you want. But also, if you want to have the same thing we're doing, by having the same thing every week, you can bring the same thing, and there's some benefits to that. The flip side of that, though, is there are some benefits to having at your fingertips a multiple translations in your study. So as you are studying through a certain passage, having the benefits of having several things. Now, I remember when I was in seminary, this hasn't been that long ago, this has already begun to change, but I remember Jim Renahan encouraged us as pastors to every time we saw a different, you know, go to a thrift store or whatever, and there would be a different translation of the Bible there for cheap, grab it, so you have that resource. Well, at this point, that's really not necessary. I did that for a while, but I really got to the point where, like, why? You're just taking up shelf space when I can don't have to spend that much money to get my Bible software, and the ones I don't want to spend money on, they're all available online. So go to Bible Gateway or something like that, and you've got every translation you can think of right there at your fingertips. And so we do have a great benefit of that. We don't have to go out and buy 15 different translations to have the various translations as a resource. But we can use them. And there's a lot of benefits. We'll look at a couple of them here. We can see the range of meaning. So as you look at a different word, how it's been translated, sometimes just an individual word. What's the range of meaning of this word? The Greek or Hebrew word, the Aramaic word, and the different translations can show you that range of meaning. And then also you can see the range of interpretation. So just like we just did with 1 Corinthians 7, you can see the variety of ways in which a passage is interpreted to begin to get a picture of the underlying language that's being used to get a picture of the point that is being made. Okay, let's kind of go by way of introduction. Are there any questions or comments before we kind of get into the science of translation this morning? If not, let's go ahead and dive in. So let's think about one of the first questions that comes up in the translation is which text? And what I mean by this, which is the underlying text? Because there's a lot of them. The reality is, as the book points out, and used the illustration of the Declaration of Independence. If you want to know what Thomas Jefferson wrote on the Declaration of Independence, you can go to, I believe it's Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. I think it's Philadelphia where it's under glass. You can see his original handwritten copy, under glass, protected, and you can look at the original. No copies, no errors, unless he just made a mistake on his original. But what he wrote is right there. We can't do that with any book, any verse of the Bible. We do not have a single original copy, what's often called the autographs. In fact, the earliest fragments we usually have really don't even begin, we're talking fragments. We don't have any complete copies until a long time after. The fragments begin at the end of the first century. We've got a couple of, like the Gospel of John, something like that, that's just, you know, two or three verses, hardly anything. We really don't start seeing full manuscripts for a couple hundred years, and really 300 or 400 years after they were written, of the New Testament. Now, the Old Testament, we have the primary thing we'll talk about we have written well after. We do have some that are written right at the end. But the reality is we don't have original autographs. The extant manuscripts that we have range about 1,400 years. That's just the New Testament, from the time of Christ to the time that we have them, about 1,400 years of range of which in which they were written. Especially the New Testament, this is not as quite as much the Old Testament, and especially the New Testament, we have thousands of manuscripts with thousands of variants. Now, most of these variants are trivial. What I mean by that is they don't really, they're inconsequential. An extra letter or something like that makes absolutely no difference. It's no trouble whatsoever figuring out what was trying to be said. You know, misspelled words, things like that. The problem is that sometimes misspelled words are no big deal. They come along and you can tell exactly what was trying to be said. There are sometimes the misspelled words become very, very serious, because sometimes, as we can think about it, even in our own context, change one letter of a word and it changes the word entirely and it changes the meaning entirely. And the same thing is true of Greek and Hebrew. So while most of them are a bit trivial, there are some ones that make a little bit more difficult. Determining the correct text, trying to determine exactly what is said, is the work of textual criticism, trying to figure out what is said exactly. So the point is that we don't have the originals. What we have is a bunch of copies, and so we're going to have issues. Now, let me explain and try to illustrate a little bit about how this works as far as the initial. So if I got up here today and I had everybody take out a piece of paper, and start writing stuff down. Let me get to that in a moment. Let's go ahead and go through what we have. So let's think about the sources for a moment. So in the Hebrew text, we have a handful of sources. The primary source that is used for most modern translations are what's known as the Masoretic text. And I say most modern translations. It's really even the King James used the Masoretic text, and most modern translations use the Masoretic text. In between the King James and the modern translations, there was a few that decided that the Masoretic text weren't reliable and changed. And then as we got cutting out four people, it's like, no, the Masoretic texts really are the best. Now, the difficulty with the Masoretic text, I've got 10th century, that's 10th century A.D. So how long after the Old Testament was finished are those written down for us?
At least 1,000 years.
Yeah, 1,400 years since the last of the Old Testament. And that's the tail end of it. How long since most of the Old Testament was written? It's a long, long time. And so that's been the question mark with the Masoretic text. Now, the difference is, and we'll think about this more in just a moment, is the reason they have reliability is there was a very exacting copying tradition that the Jewish people had. So they are pretty reliable. And what's been interesting is we found some of the other things to compare them with is finding out how reliable they really were. The next thing we have is Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint is not actually in Hebrew, but it's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, written ranging, what we have ranges from the 2nd century BC to the 4th century AD. The most we have around the 2nd century is actually just fragments. The complete manuscripts we have are more closer to the 4th century AD. Septuagint is 770. Supposedly 70 rabbis sat down, translated, and got the exact same thing on the first try, And therefore, we have this perfect translation of the Greek, the Hebrew Old Testament. Yeah, probably a lot more myth than truth. But if you read the New Testament and you read the Old Testament says, most of the time it is quoting the Septuagint. Christ and the apostles, that was their scripture, was the Septuagint. They didn't use the Hebrew, they used the Greek Septuagint. And so most of what they're doing is that. That's why you'll see at times in different language from the New Testament, because they're not reading the Hebrew, they're reading the Greek. And but it's very important, because while it's not in Hebrew, it still does attest to what was understood the scripture to mean. Now, there's a very, very important verse in scripture. The Septuagint is very significant for us, and that in showing the issue of interpretation, but also what the understanding was at the time. So in Isaiah prophesies, "Behold, a virgin shall come," or the Hebrew word was more, to our understanding, is more often to be understood not as virgin, as young woman. And so if we go back, remember I said there's a space where some of the translators, there was a lot of question about this. Well, you know, the RSV, I believe it was back 75 years ago, something like that, when it came out, decided to translate that young woman. And it caused, for those that are old enough to remember that, it caused a furor amongst much of Christianity, because they decided that Isaiah should be translated young woman, not virgin. And so seen as a direct denial of the virgin birth. And on the one hand, the reality is, if you look at, for most of our understanding of Hebrew, that actually was an accurate translation. But one of the reasons, there's two reasons why we emphasize that it should be taken as virgin. One of them is the fact the New Testament is very specific that it was virgin birth. And secondly, if the Septuagint. The Septuagint translates it in the Greek equivalent for virgin. And so evidently, even though from our viewpoint it means young woman, even the Jewish people at that time, pre-Christ, understood that that was talking about a virgin. And so that's one of the reasons that the Septuagint is significant, because it helps us to understand the way in which the Jewish people were understanding these words to mean at that time. An important discovery that has been found more recently is the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are the oldest Hebrew manuscripts we have. They date from about 150 BC to about 70 AD. When I was in Israel, I got to see where they actually found them. Those of you who don't know the story, it's a crazy story. Two little farmer boys are sheep herders out in the desert, see a cave. They think one of their sheep is in the cave, but it's dark. They don't have lights, so the one throws a stone in there to see if anything's in there, hoping he doesn't hear a growl or something like that. Instead of hearing a growl, he hears jars shattering. He goes back, brings people back, and they find this just repository of ancient texts and just all kinds of these of Hebrew Old Testament, copies of the Old Testament, or at least different sections of it. And what's been fascinating with those is they have shown us just how accurate the Masoretic texts are. The Masoretic texts, although they're more complete, the Masoretic texts are written, you know, copied down 1,000-plus years later, are almost identical, hardly any differences. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls are not complete. They don't have the entirety of the Old Testament, but they do have some large sections of it, especially like Isaiah and things like that. And they help demonstrate just how faithfully they copied. Then there's a variety of just Old Testament translations. So around the time of Christ and prior, the Jewish people during the dispersion, as they're being scattered all over the ancient Near East, they were copying the Bible into their local languages. And so we have those. And again, they help us see not what the exact original wording was, but help us to get an idea of what the original wording was or what the understanding of those words were, because they show us what was being understood in the various languages. And so they're significant. Switching to Greek, we have the Alexandrian. There's about three families of Greek texts. The Alexandrian texts, primarily out of Alexandria, Egypt. Why is Alexandria, Egypt, significant in this? Yes.
Alexandria was basically the center of the Greek educational world.
Yeah, exactly. And there, you know, the Library of Alexandria, great library, and so there was a ton of scribes there. It was a very significant cultural epicenter around the time of Christ and for a few hundred years after Christ. And so some of the most important manuscripts we have come from there. The majority of and again, I see I'm 4th century there because most of the manuscripts we have from Alexandria are around the 4th century AD. Then we have the Byzantine majority text. They go by either one of these names, Byzantine, because they're the Byzantine family. They're also called the majority because they count for about 80% of the manuscripts we have come from that. But about pretty much the earliest ones we have, about the 5th century, most of the ones we have are closer to the 14th century. And so they're vastly removed, and there are some significant differences. And we'll talk about some of that in just a moment. There's a third group. These are a very, very small group. This is the Western things. They are different. They're early. They're similar in age to the Alexandrian texts. We only have a handful of them. And there seem to have not been a very heavy attempt to really be an accurate copying of them. There are a lot of paraphrases, a lot of abbreviations, and they're not real reliable for anything. They're not really heavily relied on. They're there, but again, there's not even, I don't think we even have a full New Testament of the Western ones. They're just partial manuscripts, and there's not very many of them. I think 14 or 15 total, whereas we've got thousands of the others. And just a handful of those. And so we have that issue. Now let's go ahead and think about this for a moment. Let me go one more slide here. So the question is, should the variations in these various texts concern us? Now if you study, you see there's a couple different people who want to make a big issue out of the variations, both secular and religious. So within Christian circles, groups like the King James Only movement, in modern times, the Latin Vulgate only movement 400 years ago, and others, go back way back, and then it's the old Latin only movement when the Latin Vulgate was written. And you think I'm being funny? You read the writings of when the new translations came out, when the Vulgate was written, and when the English, and it's the exact same arguments that King James Only is used today. There's a fear of variety. Because if there's variety, there's differences, and if there's differences, can we trust it? And so that's the question that comes up. And so we have that text within our camps. Then from without, we have those that come along and say, how can you believe the Bible? There's thousands of different copies and thousands of variants. How can you trust it? And so we have that attack come along as well. And so should we be concerned about these variations? Well, to some extent, variations in hand copying should be expected. If you're copying things by hand, it's going to be expected. Now, the way this thing, especially for the Greek copying, the way it was normally done was you would have a situation like this. We have people spread out around a room, a bunch of scribes. Mine's in a not brightly lit with fluorescent lights. It's probably a candle sitting at the person's desk. And one person would be up front, and he would read it. And he would read a line, and everybody would write it down. So think about this morning. If each of you took a piece of paper, and I read you a page of the Bible, and you tried to write down as I was writing, how many mistakes do you think you would make? Some more than others. That is for sure. And do you think anybody would get it perfect? Every single letter correct? Probably not. Especially when you don't have a lot of standardized spelling and things like that. So then the question comes, would if we took everything that was... remove my copy from the equation, could we figure out what my copy said from your copies?
Yes.
How would we do that?
Compare them.
Because you probably didn't all make the same mistake. And if we take each word and see, okay, the one person made this mistake, but everybody else got this. And so, okay, well, we can tell this person made this mistake. And then move to the next word. And we say, everybody got this one right. And we move to the next word and say, well, two people got it wrong, but they got it wrong differently. This person, added an E, this person left off a B. But everybody else spelled it this way, so everybody else must be right. And we can move through, and by the time it's said and done, we should be able to assemble a copy that's pretty much identical to the other. And so that's one of the things to think about with that. But there's also another issue, and that is variations actually reinforce reliability. And this is an important thing for us to consider. I think I'll probably just spend the rest of my time on this thought, and then we'll come back next week and finish up. But let's think for a moment about these various texts, because this is an important issue. Having been raised in a more King James or only environment, this is a big issue in that environment. That is, can we rely on these texts when they have variations? But I want us to think about this for a moment. There is a religion out there right now that does not have variations. They love to trumpet the fact that they have no variations as the proof that they are correct and Christianity is wrong. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Islam.
And Islam, the modern, they don't have variations in their manuscripts. Now, does anybody know why Islam has no variations in their manuscripts?
I think there was a gentleman named Ithmun who burned up all the manuscripts and rewrote them to match all.
So back 1,000 years ago or so, a little less, he had a single man who gathered up all the manuscripts, decided which one he thought was the correct one, and then burned the rest of them. So the question is, the question that Islam is facing is, did he burn the right ones? Okay, their face, on the one hand, they want to yell at us, how can you know which one's correct? You've got so many variations. And our answer back is, how do you know you have the right one? You burn the rest of them.
Nothing to compare to.
Now, let's think about this for a moment. One of the things let's go back to the difference between the Alexandrian and the Byzantine texts, okay? And we have there, the KJV only has people like that want to emphasize Byzantine because there's so many of them. There's 80% of our texts are Byzantine. Now, let's switch metaphors for a moment. Let's go to let's say we witnessed a murder. Say two people here, say Phil and I have witnessed a murder, okay? And we're called before, but we saw it a little differently. We have a little different view on what it does. So Phil tells one person about what he saw, and I tell 10. Now, when it comes to court, can the 10 people that I tell go in, and the two people that Phil and the one person he told, can his one person and my 10 go in, and the judge will say, okay, well, 10 people gave this story, and one person gave this story, so we're going to go with 10. Yeah. In fact, the judge is going to say, I don't care. I don't care how many people were told. I'm not listening to anybody but the original eyewitnesses, because they're the only ones that matter. Now, if, let's say, something happens to Phil and I, and of course, in court situations, probably just the case can get mistrial or just tossed or something like that. But let's say in general situation, we have to know something's going on. Now, let's say after we told those people, Phil and I both died. So now we can't. You can't ask them. Ask us. Does it still matter that I told 10 and Phil told 1?
To an extent at the end, it all depends on what you actually told them, whether you told them correctly or not. But what I mean is
But I guess the point is there any weight in the fact that 10 heard from Phil or from me, and only one heard from Phil?
Yeah.
There's nothing. It's hearsay on both counts. It's secondary. And that's the point with the Byzantine texts, that we have to, as we look at the fact, yes, there's a ton of them, but most of them are late copies. And as we go back through, we trace back through the copies, we begin to figure out where the mistakes are made. We could also think of it, how many of you have played the telephone game? You know what I'm talking about, where you get everybody in line, one person gets the first story, and they whisper to the person next to them, the ear, and goes in the line, and by the time you get to the end, it's completely different, because every time it's copied, more and more errors are added. Well, that's kind of the point that's going on there. And so on the one hand, as we begin to have these copies, we're going to expect there to be mistakes. We're going to expect there to be errors. And so it is good to go back and find the earlier copies. Now, again, as we're doing that, there's a variety of different types of errors that can come in. That we'll think about that more next week when we get into the second half of this. There's going to be a different types of errors made. Sometimes it's going to be stuff added. Sometimes it's going to be stuff removed, but most likely it's going to be stuff added. And this is one of the things that King James only just get all upset about. They'll take verses of modern translations and say, well, so they removed a verse. Well, did they actually remove a verse, or did the later text add a verse? You know, it goes both ways. That's part of the issue, is determining which it did. But here's the question, and we want to come back to the point, is okay, we have these variations, we have to figure out what they are, but does it harm us? Well, the point is that actually the variations reinforce the reliability. Because going back to the testimony now, think about this for a moment. If, let's say, let's get rid of the witnesses, and let's just bring Phil and I towards to witness things. If Phil and I tell the exact same story, what is the defense attorney going to bring up? What's his collaboration? Because why is that significant? Why is he going to bring that up?
Because you're two different people.
We're two different people seeing it with two different eyes.
It's different perspectives.
Different perspectives.
Yeah. Together.
Yeah. That's where you have to get. That's where you get in trouble. Is where two people give the exact same story. That's when you have to be questioned. Is this real? That's why that's the Quran's problem. Is there is no other copies, and so the question is you know, are they collaborating? The very fact that we have this variety, but at the end of the day, most of the variety is trivial. Most of the variety doesn't matter for anything. It's completely and totally insignificant. Most of them, it's very obvious what the mistake was made. It's just not an issue at all. It's very 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 simple. Where it isn't, it still doesn't make much difference as far as what the passage means. We can figure it out. Even some of the passages where the mistakes are the most pronounced as far as trying to figure out exactly what word should be there. And there's one that he uses in the book from Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13. And there's a word, there's one letter difference between fire and boasting. And so a lot of debate over the two words there. But even then, while there's a huge difference between the definition of boasting and the definition of fire or burned, but at the end of the day, the Paul's point that's being made doesn't really change no matter which word you put in there. It's pretty obvious what the interpretation of the passage is. And so those are the types of things that's the positive. So we have all these translations, all these manuscripts. And yes, there's variations, but most of them are not important. The ones that are, we can usually come to a pretty good agreement on what should be there. It's really only a handful of passages that there's really continues to be a lot of debate over what they actually mean. But here's the point that we want to make. There's two things that are at the heart of this. First of all, the very fact that we have variation shows that we have a variety of people doing it. It emphasizes that we have all these different witnesses. And at the end of the day, they don't differ all that much. They're basically all saying the same thing. And secondly, at the end of the day, there's no doctrine that is jeopardized by the variations. Now, if you talk to some King James onlyists, they will try to tell you the deity of Christ and things like that are jeopardized. But it's not. I have no trouble defending the deity of Christ from the ESV or even the NIV. I can actually defend the deity of Christ from the Message and other paraphrases. These doctrines are not in jeopardy by this. The Bible, as it is written, is very, very, as we have it, as we've received it, is very, very, we're able to put things together very well. So we should not be worried about the fact there's the text. The reason it's important for us to understand this is so that we can understand what's going into it. When we see marginal notes in our Bibles, and footnotes and things like that, and saying, well, some translations or some manuscripts have it as this. Understand what's going on there, why they're making these types of things, these types of issues, and go through from there. So it's important for us to understand them to a degree, but also not to get worried. It's actually, there's actually positives of this, and we can go through pretty confident that we have the Word of God. I remember years ago I was teaching a Sunday school class, and I was, every week, and we were going through the Confession of Faith, and every week I would print out the, because one of the people in the group asked me to, because I was doing it myself, I would just go through and cut and paste all the texts that were the proof texts for the confession that were in it, and I would have them in my little binder, and one of the people in the class asked me to do the same thing for them, so I would do that every week, I'd print it out. And I had one of the guys in the group was a King James only person, and he got all upset. If people were copying the Bible like this down to the centuries, we wouldn't have a Bible today. I looked down to this a whole lot more accurate than the way it was copied down the centuries. I was able to go to a computer and print this out and have it printed out exactly. Down the centuries, they're copying it by hand, verses by verse. And most of what we have, most of the manuscripts are a lot of that, just a couple of verses here, a couple of verses there that people wrote down at different times. And we actually have The fact that God has preserved his word the way he has is a wonderful thing. Yes, we don't have the original autographs. Yes, there are some passages that we have variations that we have questions about. But overall, the scope of God's word, we have it. And we can be confident in it. We can embrace it and know that it is trustworthy and that God has preserved it, in spite of the fact that for thousands of years there was attempts to destroy it, attempts to banish it, to get rid of it. People kept copying it, kept finding it, and we just keep finding manuscripts all over the world where people have copied it, both Greek, Hebrew, but also other translations into other languages around the world. And so we do have that. Trying to see if I want to stop here. I think I'll go just slightly forward. So let's think about a little bit with the science of translation here. So having said that, textual criticism then is a science that works. It's the science of translations. How do we come to, as with translation, the science of understanding what the manuscripts are. So textual criticism is a science that works with careful controls. And again, if you talk to some people, there's an idea that somehow textual criticism is just this great liberal conspiracy in which to get rid of the Bible. Actually, textual criticism, for the most part, is a very exact science using a set of rules. We're not going to go through all those rules. There's entire books on the subject if you want to study it further. But going through, thinking through how do we, what do the various words say? So it's a science. They're looking at both external evidence and internal evidence. Now, having said, though, that it's a science, we need to keep in mind that textual criticism is not an exact science. And if it was an exact science, you'd have all the critics come to the exact same conclusion every time they came to a passage. Most passages they do, but there are passages that they don't. If you go through your ESV, you'll see different places where you'll have marginal notes. And then basically a lot of marginal notes are indicating that even the ESV translators, the committee that put together that, couldn't decide on the proper reading. So usually when that's an issue, they put a marginal note in to say it may be something else. So it's not an exact science. But let's think real quickly about what the external evidences are and what the internal evidences are. Now, we won't go through all of these in great detail, but just kind of give a couple of things to think about. First of all, the age of the manuscript. Think about this in the terms of the telephone game. The third person down the line, it probably already has some corruptions in it from the first thing that was said, but they're going to be a whole lot closer to the original than the person at the end of the line. Every time something's copied, the more likely it is to have an error in it. And so the closer we are to the original, the more likely it is to be the right thing. And so the age of the manuscript is important. That's why, yes, we have a ton of Byzantine texts, but when they're, the 500th copy written at the end of the 14th century, they're just not considered as important as one that was the first copy written in the 4th century. There's a recognition that at that time, there's going to be more and more errors the later you get. And most of the Byzantine manuscripts are very, very late in their translation.
Rob,
yes?
So I heard Erman, he's always talking about, you guys are just trusting a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, And he's trying to use that exact argument against the fact that even the ones we do have, how do we know how accurate they can be? Because, what if the 4th century there's been copied like over and over again? And I think a lot of James White or somebody's arguing, against that, something like, they don't necessarily, they would use that same copy that was older, and they would kind of branch off a copy off that, and those copies would go out.
Yeah.
And then other people say, it went from German to Latin to this, and you're copying after that. No, they would go to the original as far as they could. Most translators would go to the original and go from that. But I don't know.
Yeah, because keep in mind, that's a good point. So think about the illustration we gave a moment ago. Which is going to be more accurate? All of you copying off of, as I speak it, you each writing down your own copy, but all coming off of what I'm doing, okay? Yes, every single one of your copies is going to have errors. But it's going to be, I'll have a lot less errors than if I go over here and I start on this side of the room and I tell somebody over here something and they tell the person next to them and it works all the way across to get over here to Sharon. That's, by the time Sharon gets it, it's going to be in really bad shape.
And that's what Erman's saying was done, right?
Yeah, that's what Erman is saying was done. And to a degree, that's what we do have with the Byzantine text. That's why, yes, the late 14th century Byzantine texts, we have a ton of them. Those are copies of copies of copies of copies of copies. They've been copying them for thousands of years by that, or not thousands of years, but a couple thousand, 1,500 years by that point, hundreds of years. And that's why, yes, we expect to see a lot of errors there. But when we go back to the earliest copies that are written in the 4th century, that and a lot of them, at the Council of Nicaea, one of the things, one of the conclusions that was made at the Council of Nicaea was to put together several complete manuscripts of the New Testament at that time. And it is believed a lot of our Alexandrian manuscripts come from that. They were there, those are the original Council of Nicaea manuscripts that were put together. They're pretty original. I mean, they're very, very early. They're not copies of copies of copies. And again, there's more that idea of most of the time, they understood this. You know, the Hebrew people, one of the reasons the Masoretic texts, as we find the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find that the Masoretic texts are pretty accurate, even though they are copies of copies of copies. They were very, very careful in how they did things. The Masoretes would actually count letters on pages in order to make sure that there was the exact right amount of letters on every single page that they copied in order to help maintain. If there's a single letter off, then we got to go back through and figure out where the mistake was. And they were careful a lot of times. Now, sometimes they weren't careful. There's a difference between, as Phil put it, some people are going to be better than others. You have professional scribes, this is their job, is to copy manuscripts. And then you have some layperson who can't afford to hire a scribe, so they go do it themselves. And it's a lot of things going in. But the thing is, we also, one of the beauties, though, of the two branches, the Byzantine and the Alexandrian branch, is that you have two different parts of the world copying them, and you still have mostly overlap.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so if Ehrman's point is correct, then you really should expect to see no ability whatsoever to reconcile. By the time you get to the end of the Alexandrian and the Byzantine, no ability to even reconcile the two.
Right. Right.
The very fact that we can demonstrates that there's more going on there. Yes?
The other thing, too, is they try to make a huge deal about how we can't trust the biblical copies because of this. But this is true of any ancient text. I mean, we don't have autographs of anything. I mean,
no. And ironically, and very ironically, because it's Ehrman himself who makes this point, is that the reality is that we actually have earlier manuscripts of the New Testament than we do any other ancient text. The very fact that we have copies of the New Testament that come to us within 100 or so years after the New Testament was written, whereas most of the other sources of that era, Josephus and things like that, we don't have copies anywhere near that close. Most of the extant copies of ancient writings were written thousands, or the copies that we have are copied thousands of years after the original, or after the events. Ehrman's very inconsistent on a lot of these points. On the one hand, he'll acknowledge, as I heard a deal, he was on a radio program with an atheist years ago, and the atheist is kind of going off on how we've got to, about time we get to dispel the myth of Jesus, that Jesus ever existed. And Ehrman looks at him and says, no, he says, I don't believe Jesus was God, but if you're going to have any kind of historical scientific method, you have to acknowledge that Jesus existed. There's too many evidences to the fact of his life. And if we're going to say, if you're going to deny that the writings indicate Jesus lived, then the criteria you're saying, distance and things like that, then you have to say Alexander the Great didn't exist, because we have more evidence that Christ exists than we have Alexander the Great. Ehrman's, on the one hand, again, the problem is he has to acknowledge the historical method, which is, in reality, so much textual criticism is just using historical method, how we study any other ancient text. At the same time, he's committed to rejecting the fact that the Bible teaches us about God. I still love the comment about Ehrman. I don't know how many of you know this. Ehrman was actually a fundamentalist Christian growing up. And now he's just a fundamentalist atheist. And as one Christian apologist put it, it's just a great example of, you can take the boy out of fundamentalism, but you can't take the fundamentalism out of the boy. Ehrman's still a fundamentalist. He still has the same preconceived ideas about the world that he had in his fundamentalist youth. He's just changed his commitments. And he is, but it's a lot of the problems that he has are, he has seen through the problems a lot of fundamentalist attitudes towards the text without coming to grips with the more proper attitudes towards it. Okay, we'll go ahead and come back to this next week. We're over time now.